Welcome to Everything Belongs, a podcast for those living, creating, leading, and thriving while in the deep end of life. I'm your host, Madison Morgan, leadership coach, creative consultant, and speaker. I coach soulful visionaries and go-getting mavericks who desire to create art of their lives and take their work both deeper and higher. In this show, I'll be bringing you an overflow of conversations with my favorite thought leaders, teachers, healers, and creatives who inspire me to live more fully in my own power, worth, and wholeness, along with offering some episodes where I share my own practical insights, behind-the-scenes peeks into my process, and tools I use on my own journey. There will not be much we shy away from here because at this table, everything belongs. Therefore, you can expect me to ask the uncomfortable, juicy questions. You can expect that you'll hear people you disagree with on the podcast and maybe even ideas you've never previously considered. I trust you with your own discernment as we take this deep dive. You can expect to laugh, cry, learn, and be challenged by the guests as they share their diverse experiences and views of the world. It's my hope through learning to see that all of it belongs that you will develop a more sovereign way of holding yourself so you can playfully go after the life, relationships, and career you are made for, to let all parts of yourself have a seat at the table, to lead and create from your deepest truth and become your own source of validation, all because you finally know you're worthy of it. All that's required to get started, that you show up curious and willing. Let's dive in. Hey, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of Everything Belongs. I'm your host, Madison, and I am so glad to have you. I cannot believe it is mid-October, but I am certainly loving this weather, this slowdown. If you've been following my work, you know that we just got done with an intake of Awaken Her Soul, and today actually is the day we're kicking off Unlocking Module 1. And this episode with Philip Eastman could not be more timely because this episode is about how we are not what we produce. And although all of my work is about our worthiness outside of what we produce and what we do in the world, running an online business can certainly make products of people. And it can be a shadow side of what I do. Is like, I love the work of coaching, but the part of marketing that can be putting yourself out there like a performance or like a product, it can feel like we are on this never-ending hamster wheel of being what we produce and like our production having a lot to do with how much money we make if we're not careful. And although I don't buy into that, and I actually am attempting to make a really big transition in the way that I market my business in general using social media. In this episode, you're really going to hear some of the shadows that I personally struggle with in our society that has not just made who we are and our worthiness connected to what we produce, but in social media, how we have done that to each other more than ever. And so in this conversation with Philip Eastman, you're going to hear not just his understandings of late stage capitalism and divesting our value from what we produce, but a way to really start to see other people, especially on the internet, as people and not products, and to divest from the pressure to churn out content that will really slow us down and bring us more into our bodies, bring us more into our feelings, and help us relate to each other as people. Which is absolutely what the heart of what I want my work to be about is. And so Philip Eastman, if you're not familiar with him, is a writer, a photographer, a filmmaker, and by his words, a passionate anti-capitalist. He's a believer that much of the mental health struggles that American life is rooted in is because of the rugged individualism and the cutthroat ideologies of neoliberalism and patriarchal power structures. And so that is a mouthful. And he has, as he will share, extensive personal experience with mental health struggles and has learned to take the winding path of forgiveness. And so this conversation really dives into that path of forgiveness, understanding what some of those words are that I didn't even know what they meant before asking him what they meant, and to really understand our individual shame that can help us start to survive and then even thrive. And so this conversation, maybe it will interest you if you are even curious what an anti-capitalist is, because Whenever I hear that word, I have this idea of what someone who's anti-capitalist might be like. But Philip offers such a compassionate view of living inside of systems that maybe aren't working for us and how to go about doing that in the most human way possible. So without further ado, let's dive into this conversation with Philip Eastman on We Are More Than What We Produce. Philip, I'm super happy to be with you. And obviously we connected originally through Instagram, and I just felt so immediately connected to your writing. And I felt like you were someone who understands the concept of late stage capitalism in one, a way that I'd never heard anyone speak about it, but two, through a lens of a lot of compassion. And it felt less, I don't want to say less political, it's certainly political, but less through the lens of political parties and more through the lens of humanness, which felt really approachable for me because I was like, I don't know anything about this topic. And also I was like, oh, whenever you're talking about it, I just connect to the humanness of the conversation.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, it's still surreal to hear how my writings are interpreted, because even when you share things on social media, oftentimes I feel like I put them out into the world and I don't think about the fact that people are actually reading the words and being affected by them. In the same way, when someone in your life close to you observes a behavior about you, let's say, and you're like, oh yeah, people are seeing me out in this world because we're in our own consciousness. I know this sort of sounds like a stony comment, but it's lovely to hear that is the reaction to what I share, because I would say it's not been, one thing I often say is like, these opinions weren't nurtured into me by anyone close. It came from a lot of mistakes and a lot of struggles. And I've struggled with depression, and in some cases, suicidal depression, since I was 14, runs in the family. If you ascribe to that belief that, it is genetically inherited. And I experienced some traumatic events in my childhood, witnessed some violence, and parents divorce, and just gloss over it, but the difficulty of separation and what that does to a child. And it's been a long journey of trying to get deeper and deeper into why I'm affected by certain circumstances. And I think I arrived at my current beliefs. I guess I would call myself an anti-capitalist, which often spooks people. They think I mean, or it scares people. They think I mean, that I dislike money or that I want to burn down the system. I'm pointing out that this relationship we are currently in is not working. And I'll make things analogous to, if you're in an intimate relationship, you need to figure out that it's not working before you make changes. And the avoidance that it's not working usually just makes it not work even more. But I started reading and exploring about alternatives to capitalism so I could understand why I felt such a consistent level of shame, whether I was doing well financially or not, because I've gone through, as an artist, different iterations of doing well enough financially to be okay. My initial career was, I acted in commercials in Los Angeles. I left college with a significant amount of student debt. Was very much encouraged to borrow the money to go to a private university, USC. And my family did not have the money to pay for the education. And I was told by many advisors that it would pay itself off in dividends. And it was extremely burdensome to leave college and immediately have to pay all this stuff off. And I went into acting because it sort of worked out within a year. And then I stuck with the job, even though I didn't necessarily feel comfortable advertising products for money. And I felt pretty empty. I felt like I was just, a salesperson who was not invested in what I was doing. Not everyone has to be this way, and I don't consider myself extra special, but I would like for the work I do to have some purpose or meaning beyond myself. And in that particular occupation, I felt like I was just living for myself. And it was nice to have a comfortable amount of money. I would say it was like a middle-class income. I was never ultra wealthy from it, but I just kept kind of excavating and digging deeper as to like, why this can't just be depression from my life not working out in a certain way. And at the tail end of when that career was kind of phasing out for me, I left Los Angeles, had a breakup with a long-term partner, and also moved away to reconnect with my, at the time, estranged father. So life sort of culminated all these difficult circumstances at once. And I would say it pretty much broke me. In 12-step programs, you would say you hit bottom. I ruined a relationship. I left a career. I was left with no money, heavily in debt, and was looking at what my value systems had been, where they had led me, and why I was consistently finding myself deeply, deeply unhappy. And it was affecting all my personal relationships. I went through a couple of years of extreme rage and anger, and that affected my romantic relationship, obviously, and was a big element in the dissolution of our relationship. I like to talk about that because I think it's important to acknowledge that we can be hurt and still be hurtful. And that also, if we believe in a sort of restorative model that many of us are seeking, that we are allowed to make amends and forgive ourselves and grow. I would say after that, I returned back to Los Angeles, and that was when I began really looking at like, okay, I'm in my early 30s. I sort of accomplished my big goals in my 20s, but now I was in this inverse situation where I was worse off financially than I was when I left college. I had less prospects. I had more financial stress. I was on the verge of filing for bankruptcy, which I ultimately did, which was a mixture of medical debt that I'd accumulated from not having proper health insurance that I'd carried over for years, and then just survival debt from graduating right around the time of the recession. And I was looking at all these factors that I had just normalized in my life, a recession which made it so I was working full time but never making enough to pay my bills. It being normal that I had to get a proper credit card to pay off this medical debt. And I started to see like, wait a second, it's not that I would be 100% happy if these things didn't exist in my life, but these are systemic issues. I live in a system that makes me feel bad that I didn't have enough money to pay for medical care when it could, with policy choices, we could pay for medical care. There's a lot of stresses that would have been alleviated in my previous relationships, friendship, family, and romantic, had I not been felt like there was this elephant in the room, that there was the monthly payments for my student loans, that there was this $100,000 debt that was going to get in the way of any sort of growth in my life. So for me, I just started to look at these things because it wasn't that I needed an excuse, but I was fully blaming myself at the time, and I was fully living in shame and kind of wallowing in this sense of that I was an unforgivable person. And I started to see that there are elements in the system that do this to many, many people besides myself. And that was a big awakening for me. I started to connect with a lot more folks who shared similar experiences or were born into them. And so when I say that I mentioned this earlier, sort of before we were recording, that I was born into an upper middle class area, Marin County, north of San Francisco, which is a pretty safe, highly segregated, liberal place to grow up that is also ripe with its own problems too. And in the eyes of many folks from that community, I was considered a failure because I ascended in a career and then descended. And I know I'm sort of presenting a lot of things all at once here, but that was the beginnings of me wanting to understand, okay, if I feel unhappy in this system and others do as well, why are we doing this? And then from a broader view, when I see that the planet is suffering and I see that there's enough resources to go around for everyone to eat, for everyone to have shelter, and for everyone to have care, but the dominant narrative is you need to earn your basic needs. You need to prove that you are worthy of your basic needs, and how normal that was for me for so many years, because I was in a community that told me that was normal. And when I began to connect with people who suggested, you know, activists, people involved in mutual aid groups, you know, reading Adrienne Marie Brown, Octavia Butler, like Angela Davis, I started to expose myself to alternative modes of thought. When I say alternative, I'd say away from the dominant patriarchal white, essentially white ideology that America and the Western world is run by. And it was difficult because, difficult in the sense that I wasn't around people at the time who could reflect that back to me. But I think sometimes we intuitively know that we're living in communities or living in toxic environments, but we don't have the language to verbalize it. And I think the body acts out. I think the depression that I was experiencing in different parts of life was a lighthouse trying to tell me something rather than an affliction that needed to be healed, so to speak. So in the modern context, I think I've just been slowly and steadily trying to extract myself from those conditionings and essentially like rebuild my entire perspective. And as I did it, I found that when I shared these things with others, there was a reaction. People identified with it. In my, you know, small little community of people that I shared with, there was a lot of folks who harbored similar feelings, whether they were connecting with people about it or not. And I felt more connected, which is a natural human response, that I wasn't completely alone. And it, essentially, I felt crazy because I'd been treated as if I was. I know that's quite a bit to lead with, but.
No, I'm so grateful that you did, because I'm remembering I was graduating high school at the recession. So you would have been a couple years ahead of me graduating college at that same time. My parents lost their entire retirement and all of their land and had to file for bankruptcy and suddenly could no longer help me with college. And so it was kind of like, if you're going, good luck. My younger sister ended up in the military and entering the army. And then our younger sister ended up not going. So in my family system, I'm the only one. My parents don't have college degrees. They also like didn't really know how to advise. But I just remember that time getting out of college and identifying that like that capitalist grind. Of course, that wasn't the language. I knew I didn't want it. And it was the rise of entrepreneurship culture. So like blogs had just come out, social media, you know, I think Instagram came out like my senior year of college or something, like 2013-ish. And realizing that there was something alternative, but also now, you know, 8 years later, however many years later, realizing that it's just like the sister of the same thing, that it's actually not like I'm seeing people who I looked up to in the entrepreneurship world who were like, we're living outside of what our parents did, experiencing the same burnout, experiencing the same fatigue, experiencing the feeling like you said, the floor is going to fall out from under them. And it kind of, in some ways, I joke with people who I've worked with that are clients that like this laptop lifestyle or like being sold, like just go live on a beach in Bali. That's the answer. Which thank God I didn't do that, but and nothing wrong with going to Bali. If people like feel like they're respecting the lands there, it's beautiful, I hear, but it's not the root of the issue. We were all trying to solve something. And I think what I'm hearing you say is that we're trying to do something to fix how we feel in a system that's not designed for us to actually thrive.
I 100% agree. And it's not possible for us to thrive by ourselves. We are communal creatures. We are meant to receive support from our communities. We are meant to, I'd say we are meant to. That's the wording I want to use. I pause for a moment, but we are meant to heal as communities. If we suffer, we should be raised up by our communities. And we do not, the United States is not a country that at present nurtures community. And you talk about the rise of, you know, entrepreneurship online and through social media. I think the darker element of that, or the reveal behind it, I think, is that that's coming as a result of basic social services not existing in this country. We do not have universal healthcare. We do not have a universal system for people to have shelter and food, even though these things are all abundantly available. Capitalism creates a false sense of scarcity, and because a small number of people control most of the means of production and most of the resources. And so if you struggle, it's your own fault. And the fear of struggling, I think, sometimes can be even greater because there are so many examples around us of how struggle is treated, where you see city councils like Los Angeles essentially criminalizing homelessness when they have the budget and have had the budget for many years to house the houseless. So there's a craven, there's a deep level of cruelty within that system. And it's very difficult to have conversations or even shift the notion toward more compassionate policy when people deeply believe that your basic needs require a performance. Western culture, in my mind, is extractive. And you mentioned some of the recommendations, like just go live in Bali, just go do these things on your own. And inherent in some of those suggestions are essentially a Western belief that you are allowed to go wherever you want, that you are allowed to use a country like Bali for your own purposes and for your own self-actualization without integrating and understanding the culture. I'm not suggesting that that's what you were doing or that what all travelers do when they go to other countries do, but America has had such a storied history of white supremacy culture essentially coming in, and we eradicated almost all of the native tribes, and we created a country based on slave labor and an economy that is still rooted in the money that was earned from that violence that persists today in different forms. So it's incongruent with having a balanced life if you're trying to seek that on your own, but you also have this deep desire to do it with others. But the system we have is so aggressive in terms of knowing that you don't have your basic needs covered. As you mentioned before, it's very difficult to take a pause unless you come from a financial position of privilege, recommending that a single mom who lives in Chicago or New York City who has three kids just take like a staycation and decompress for 2 weeks and maybe go up to Vermont and relax is, and I'm not saying these are the specific.
It is laughable.
Yeah. But it's like, that's not possible for some people.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to galvanize people to dream and think of alternatives to systems that don't work for them if they are in survival mode.
Yeah.
The brain works differently when it's in survival mode, and it's not a matter of hard work or personal choice. Your neural networks work differently if you're evicted. And if you've experienced poverty, it's a form of trauma. We have all these things that exist in the United States that are at the current moment growing and growing and growing. And we have the means to help everyone, but we have a system that views help as a weakness. Needing help is considered a failure. So at the same time, you have people who won't seek help, or if they do, they feel openly and, you know, outwardly vilified. So it's pretty tough to get people to dream alternatives. I sometimes have conversations with friends who possess different perspectives on capitalism than I do, and they say, you know, well, what's your solution? And I say, first off, I'm just one person. I do not have the solution, and I'm not going to fall prey to the idea that me as an individual, that I'm going to be some sort of hero who's going to give everyone the answer, because that's just perpetuating the same system we have, which is trying to find one iconic hero who can lead everybody. This has to come from a communal space, and it has to come from Black voices, Indigenous voices, queer voices. And at the root of anti-capitalism is just a desire for everybody to be okay. Really, the politics of progressivism, of being a progressive, is I would like for people to have food, shelter, their basic needs covered, some time to just exist, and not be having to produce and hustle to do the next thing. And for the earth to be able to regenerate its resources so we can keep living here, and not live in a state of going from crisis to crisis. And it can feel a bit like I'm living in a deja vu experience, because I know how difficult it is to get that through social media, where there's an algorithm that favors certain things. I remind myself that social media, for all the ways that it helps us communicate, and I've met some wonderful people and built community through it, it's also algorithmically designed to sell us products. That's the root of social media. It's not designed for free speech. It's heavily censored. What you say can be suppressed if it doesn't support the ideologies of a private company. And I think that's becoming more apparent as the pandemic, I think, has really brought about the need for mutual aid that was there before. But because of the lockdown, worked in a very interesting way, because it revealed who was in a position to stay home, which was recommended, and who was not. There were many folks who didn't have the option to stay home in lockdown. So even though some people had a lot of time for contemplative thought and regeneration and perspective, it definitely revealed the economic divides that we have in the United States. And I think that's helpful. I think it's helpful that stuff was laid bare, because it definitely, I think even just from a general point of view, like the pandemic has brought about, it's exposed fissures in our society. It's exposed huge divisions, but also like that certain narratives we have are harming us, and it's time for a change.
I like that you phrase it like the pandemic exposed what was already there. Of course, the pandemic has hurt and killed so many people. And whenever you're talking about capitalism, it wasn't that this divide didn't exist until the pandemic. It just further made us all aware of what was already present. Yes. And I feel, you know, in the work that I do, holding space for people and coaching, I can feel the fatigue. Mm-hmm. And I hear the fatigue from so many colleagues. And I shared with you again, the production, you know, as the apps change, and these are the main ways during the pandemic, especially, that many people are even building their businesses trying to survive, because if they don't, there's not a safety net of your basic needs are taken care of, that there's this increasing demand for performance, you know, in to be that person who shares a dream on their own podcast. I had a dream this week that I entered into an art gallery expecting to see the art. And it was both beautiful, but also like many meanings like popping up for me as I contemplate it. And I go into this art gallery and there's all these people, and I realize that I'm the show, and the music starts playing and I'm dancing. And there's a part of it that's really beautiful, but then there's also this part of it that's like, I didn't know I was there with all these people to be the show for them. I was the art, my life was the art, but then also that was the thing that was consumed. Like, I want my life to be the art. And also now, in order for me to do my work, to have a life that is art, I must perform that my life is art, which just extracts so much from it. It is just this really, I'm like, I don't like being negative about it, because it's something I'm choosing to engage in and still choosing to engage in.
Sure.
And also, it needs to be said that that's fucking exhausting.
Yeah. It can be both. And like, that's I bring this up a lot. Like, it can be both. You can acknowledge that you are choosing to engage in this, using Instagram, for example, for business purposes. And there's an inherent element, a performative element of being on social media, especially for business purposes. You can also point out that it's difficult to balance that if it feels like the goalpost keeps moving of what you need to do to deem yourself worthy of making just your basic bills, and maybe even beyond that. And it's okay for that to come from this. But I think having communal conversations about how we're affected by these things is unifying. And I guess for me, that's where my work comes in. It's just like, hey, I don't have the solution. I'm not saying that I do, but it's actually very soothing for me to hear this from you. outwardly, I would look at your business if I did not know you and wasn't familiar and think this girl is very successful. You have a gorgeously designed website. I've seen the work you do. I've seen the reviews of your work. And if I were just glimpsing, I would think this woman is set. She's completely set. She's got nothing to worry about. And having these conversations about where we struggle, what we're afraid of, helps us see our commonality. And it helps us see that like there's more of us who feel who feel disenfranchised by the system that we're in, or desire for something that's more equitable and doesn't demand that we perform at every moment. Because the difficulty of being an entrepreneur is that there's no day off. And you don't have the safety net that some folks have. I'm sort of putting that in air quotes, safety net, because you don't have a company that's providing healthcare or, paid time off, for example. You're creating all that for yourself. And I think it's an important distinction that you brought up too, that you don't come from a family background where if the floor falls out from under you, you can go somewhere for support. And I think that's more common in America than those who do have a safe space to go. Growing up with wealth is not bad. My friends who grew up in wealthy environments were given an advantage in that if they grew up in wealthy environments where they were also emotionally nurtured, which is equally as important, that provides children with a sense of safety and a sense of being able to navigate failures and reach out and take risks. Because if you unconsciously and consciously know that you will be safe no matter what happens, you're going to feel a whole lot better extending yourself out into the world. And it's okay that those advantages exist. I think it's important to talk about. And I'm hearing more conversations of people talking about that with home buying, for example. You see a lot of articles where it's the boomer versus millennial thing, where a boomer writer will say that millennials need to just buy homes and stop buying avocado toast and lattes in order to
Dave Ramsey.
Yeah.
I know him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's misguided. It's a very bad faith take. And at the same time, it's projecting onto millennials as if they're a monolith that you should just be buying a home. The people I know who've bought homes have had an inheritance or a trust or help from family. I know those circumstances are different for other people, or they're very well off in their careers, but their colleges were completely paid for. And sometimes I think I'm going to broadly say American culture, there's this avoidance of talking about the details of how we're able to live financially, because there's been such an encouragement of secrecy. I think only in recent years, people have started to reveal their salaries at work, and doing that has revealed huge sexist discrepancies that like mostly women are being paid significantly less than their male counterparts, or people of color are being paid less than their white counterparts. The more information we share, the more we're able to recognize that we're in this thing together. And so that's where, when I have conversations with friends who are doing well, or maybe they bought a home and they say like, yeah, well, I worked really hard in my career. And I go, well, yes, you did. And also it's okay that you got this, this is a fictional friend, but like, it's okay that you got $30,000 to put down on that house. You should talk to people about that. I don't mean like raise your hand at a party and always confess that that's how you did it. It's not something you should sort of you don't have to apologize for it, but being open about how we're able to do those things, again, helps us see the disadvantages in our system, who has advantages, and then we can have more nuanced conversations about how we're affected by that.
Yeah, totally. You know, and even hearing you say like from the outside in my business and what I put out, like so much of what I put out feels like art to me, which is why it's so sticky that it's also business, because the writing and the imagery, all of that feels like art. And also I have a service-based business and they go hand in hand. They've become like intertwined. And I'm just personally starting to wonder how to separate. And this actually isn't about money. It was more about the way that I was learn to self-extract in general to relate to other. So I just built a business that did the exact same thing. Like I was like, oh, I know how to do this. I'll just help people at my own expense. And now I'm starting to ask, like, what does it look like to have a life and art that is mine? Because not that it's not mine, but it is for the purpose of sharing it. And it, like, things that I wrote last year, I'm like observing that, like, because I shared them, I feel like I can't keep sharing them. Like, whereas like a book, for example, or poetry, even though that's how I feel about my work, it's like, it was already shared on Instagram before.
I see. Yeah.
Almost like a weird, like how people have that with outfits. So you can't be seen the same outfit twice, as if like, I wrote this last year, it isn't relevant anymore, in that need that you said to produce. And then you tied it back to shame. And I'm really curious about the shame element of this conversation, because you mentioned this hyper-individualism, the secrecy, the shame for also for one having privileges, shame for needing help. It's just all of the secrecy is, shame is being steeped, is what I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think shame is, it's a brilliant way to keep people in sort of a frozen state. If you feel ashamed that you're doing well, if you feel ashamed that you are doing poorly, if you feel ashamed that you're doing well, but not well enough, if you feel ashamed that, you're doing well in your career, but you would like to, like, correct me if I'm wrong here, but what I'm hearing from you is that you're recognizing, your expression has been tied to, having a monetary value. And then also, I think every artist, and I do believe that everyone is creative. So when I say creatives, I think this is true of everyone. It's okay for us to have creative elements that aren't directed toward monetizing them. And I think,
and also helping for me, it's like, I can monetize how I can help through my expression. And they're all oddly linked. Like, I will express myself, it will help someone. And that's how I'll be able to make a living or be okay. And so even if the money piece isn't there, that pattern is just a pattern that I be with in my life.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, I think about this all the time, and I do hypotheticals with my friends where I go like, is using social media, is it sort of homogenizing creativity because certain things evoke a reaction and then others see that a certain aesthetic evokes a reaction. Some people say there's an Instagram aesthetic of photography. Now, there's a way of sharing that's associated with Instagram. And I'll hypothesize. I remember reading Georgia O'Keeffe's autobiography, and she went through a period earlier in her career where she was only doing black charcoal. And she did that in a vacuum. She did that between her and Stieglitz, who was her partner at the time. And she was not yet in the phase of her career where she was living in New Mexico and heralded for floral paintings. She arrived at that without a mass audience seeing it. And sometimes I think, especially for creativity, sharing too much on social media, which I've definitely felt myself doing at the time, it takes us away from being able to create and nurture something. There's an expectation that something has to elicit a strong reaction right away. And that can be very dangerous for artists because art needs to incubate. And not every artist arrives fully formed. And an environment for commerce wants things to fit in a specific mold. I have friends who are brilliant songwriters and musicians who've played me their recordings from eighth grade when they first played music. And I could have easily told them, like, you need to stop. Do not pursue this career. This is really terrible. But they kept with it. There was not an audience there telling them to stop their creativity. Again, because, and this is perhaps idealistic of me, but the creativity was for their own nourishment. I equate things a lot to music, where like some of the most universally beloved albums, one of my favorite albums, my father's favorite albums, and many others is like Joni Mitchell's Blue, top 10. Obviously not a rare record, but that's a deeply personal breakup record. She wrote that from a very individual space applied to her. And that is why it's universal, because people can, that's what resonates with people. And it social media, because of its need for monetizing, can blur the line. For me, I've started to reintroduce creativity that I do just for myself that is never shared. To be bad at art, to collage, to play music, to sing, to do things that get my brain out of the habit of getting an audience's feedback and getting my dopamine hit from the likes, which are increasingly difficult to come by because the algorithm keeps sort of narrowing down who gets seen. Again, I think like just having conversations like this helps me get a different perspective on it too, because it's one more person I know who's trying to juggle all these various elements at the same time and live and have a career and be critical of the system and dream new ones. It's a very tall order that we're in, like a position that we're in right now.
It totally is. I think that I feel uniquely, like as I'm speaking to people for the podcast and just friends and clients, I feel like people are in a uniquely creative stage in like what else could be possible. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like that is emerging. And also the pandemic is still present. And also, you know, there's all of these things that people are also processing at the same time. And I have to be cautious also that I don't think that that represents the whole, because the people I'm having conversations with are limited. They're doing similar work. They care about similar things. And even though I'm like actively trying to get outside of that box, there's still right an echo chamber, especially in the pandemic, that we saw what that did, where we're like, oh, we're interacting with people who are quite similar. Yes. And so I don't know if my idealism is misguided. I'm like, I feel idealistic, but I'm also aware that potentially I'm living in an echo chamber of people who are like, we can find a solution, like live closer to the land.
You know, it's like, it's misguided according to whom, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, we do have echo chambers, and I'm biased in saying that if your echo chamber is encouraging communal connection and mutual aid and dreaming of alternatives, that sounds pretty, it's weird to say that that's idealistic, because I feel like the way we use idealistic means like you're aiming for something that is impossible and like naive and immature. Even though I view it as like, this is an ideal, like this would be a wonderful world to live in. Mm-hmm. I say that the most important currency for me is time. And that doesn't mean that money is not important. It's essential, but the constant hustle for getting your basic needs covered takes away time.
Hmm.
And it takes away our ability to connect with others. It takes away our ability to be present with our partners when we get home, or have a conversation on the phone and not feel like we're totally going off in another direction. And it also feeds our desire to be consumers and buy things, because it fills a void, because we need to make our time hyper efficient because there's so little of it left. Mm-hmm. I think your echo chamber is, if that's what it's encouraging, that feels like an echo chamber that can just sprout many seeds.
Yeah.
But the inverse of that is we have, there's very, dangerous echo chambers that exist online that propagate conspiracy theories and encourage violence and encourage hatred on a level that I don't think we've seen so nakedly in quite some time.
It's been so interesting. Have you read the book Cultish? Are you familiar with this book?
Oh, no.
So in my early 20s, I joined a cult, which is evangelical Christianity, but a lot of evangelicals don't have as extreme of an experience that I had. It was the community was especially culty. And I mean, long story short, I recently read this book, Cultish. Obviously I've left that community a long time ago. And she was talking about the power of language to shape cult behavior. And I have an NLP certification. And so a lot of, I don't know if you're familiar with what that is, but I understand what it NLP can do.
Powerful tool. Yeah.
Powerful tool. And when in a consensual relationship where someone's like, help me change my mind about this thing that's destroying my life, it's like, okay, that's amazing. And also companies, like it's so obvious now that I have that information and have been on the inside of cult behavior, been on the inside of an MLM, been on the inside of evangelicalism. It's all the same. The cadence is the same. The way people communicate is the same. The insider's only language is the same. And now I can see it in brands. I can see it with the rise of really famous people on social media, how they're creating these cult-like echo chambers. And it's so interesting because I have so much compassion at the same time, because it's when you're in an environment like that, the fear, the in and out, like we're in and they just don't get it, is so real. And I mean, obviously, you know what it did to the last election and what continues to happen during the pandemic. But I've observed that it's very challenging to have conversations across that divide, because it's almost like whenever I was really in evangelical Christianity and people would try to talk to me, I was speaking a different language. Those same words meant something different to me. And so people would say things and the associations I was making were totally different than what people were intending. So it's wild to me, because even like the term anti-capitalist, right, to someone who maybe hasn't spoken to you or hasn't had a conversation like this before, could elicit a completely different physiological response based on whatever their echo chamber has said about what someone who is anti-capitalist is actually doing in America.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Well, I mean, it's like the layers of it are enormous. I talk with my partner very often about, we dissect the language that we use very often, because her native language is French. And she speaks English as a second language. So she'll often ask me about like, well, what about that word? Cause I know this specific definition of it. And I will say like, oh, well, it's often used in this metaphorical way, but it actually means this. So the anti-capitalist is a big one. Another word that I know, scares quite a few people is socialism. And that's, you know, there are countless examples of what I call like false binaries, socialism as the opposite to democracy. Those aren't opposites. they're just different economic models. But within echo chambers, socialism has been associated with government takeover, lack of rights, and oppressive forces. Socialism is workers controlling the means of production. That is what it is as a definition. It's a co-op. It is not a massive takeover of all entities and your money being taken away, but it's very difficult to have nuanced conversations when we're in echo chambers that are about reacting swiftly and have been nurturing these divisions for a long time. I want to check out this book, because you talk about cult behavior, and I mean, fascism is essentially a cult. I refer to Donald Trump as a fascist dictator. I always thought that he fit the model, and our denial of what he was trying to do, our sense of like, this can't happen here, is it's a hubris in America that's still quite dangerous. But he came in at an opportune moment. This was, you know, years after the recession. The divisions caused by the recession were not mended, because we bailed out Wall Street and helped the banks just get right back at it, keep the market growing. America's social services didn't really increase or get better. People were having to work harder and more jobs to get their basic needs covered. And when someone comes in during a time of economic struggle and says, well, I'm the person who can fix all of this, you don't have to do anything, and here's the people that you need to hate, it's easy bait for quite a few people. If people are in desperate circumstances, and if you can call him charismatic, if a charismatic leader comes in and says, I will do all of it for you, it's easy for, I mean, I find him as charismatic as like a, I don't know, just like a fast food meal that's been left in the sun for a week in a gym bag.
Charismatic isn't the right word. It's
yeah,
not.
I can't. And this is just, I mean, it's not fair for me to talk about his appearance, but even just looking at him, it doesn't elicit anything about human health. I can visibly see the effects of living as an angry sociopath all on him. But he also represents the iconic American individual who does not apologize, who takes what they want, who is a maverick. And when I say we, the American story nurtured his career for years, well before he was this dangerous political figure. And it's something that we haven't really acknowledged, because America's not good at acknowledging its failures. We can't say, our government can't admit. And I've had friends say this, they're like, you're idealistic if you think the government's ever going to admit we're going to start making amends and reparations for slavery, for the genocide of Native Americans and forcing them onto reservations, or acknowledging that we created someone like Donald Trump by our value system. So there's still room for him or someone similar to him who's more cunning to come in and say, I know why you're angry and I will fix all of it for you, rather than a more nuanced conversation of, I know why you're angry and we all have to do this together and it's going to require patience and helping one another. And you may not see the immediate effects of what you do in this generation, but it will help others, because that's creating a brand new story. And that is not how Western civilization has existed, to spread and take and dominate. It's the root, I think, of most Western ideologies is violence. And you see that manifest in so many elements of our culture. So we're definitely at an interesting point, because I appreciate the echo chamber I'm in, that is very much about, and I follow a lot of people who talk about, like, this is not going to happen on our own. And I think oftentimes the sort of freeze response and the depression I see myself experience and in others experience come from this ingrained idea that we have to do it by ourselves. Like, okay, what can I do to stop climate change? What can I do to fight the government? It's all about your individual effort, which reveals that we don't necessarily have robust communities. We don't have a sense of what will we do. And then, of course, on top of that, people hear we and they think that means replacement of you. They think it's one or the other instead of both. And, you know, that takes time to nurture. And we're also kind of at a moment where, not even kind of, but we're at a moment where that needs to be expedited. The planet, first and foremost, needs us to change our approach, or our existence on this planet will not last that much longer. The planet will be fine. This is another extension of the sort of individual versus communal. Western thought doesn't connect to nature. We don't have a story that connects us to an ecology. So when we talk about climate change, for example, a lot of the fear is humans will not exist. And there's no discussion of, well, what about all of the other creatures that have become extinct because of our behavior? And there's room for us to connect to these things. But again, it takes having these uncomfortable conversations of first pointing out what doesn't work so we can start to dream the things that do.
What that brings up for me as you're talking is just the sense of grief. Mm-hmm. You know, in the book Cultish, I will say she does speak to the campaigning of Donald Trump. It's the language of fanaticism is like the tagline of the book. And so she speaks to, from like SoulCycle and Peloton to, you know, she covers the basics. Yeah. But it, as I'm hearing you talk about this and the longings of myself and the communities that I find myself creating, you know, I used to want to travel and go to all of these amazing places. And I'm thankful that in the pandemic that has really shifted. Like I keep thinking about the land and the people, and you said the biggest asset for you is time. And for me, I feel like it's relationship. Mm-hmm. And, like asking myself, how can I move towards people? And I think my mind is splintering off in so many directions. So I have so many things I want to say and ask you.
These topics are a web, yes.
Yeah, so they are. Well, I talk a lot about self-responsibility in terms of healing from codependency and healing from narcissistic abuse and healing from cult-like dynamics and what can happen in cults. And I guess I speak to something that feels very politicized and can splinter off in its own way, because I view self-responsibility as an ecology of there has to be both. It can't be just one or the other. But whenever I say that right now, I find I get these two really extreme groups of people. And one group is like, yeah, no one's going to take my guns and like, fuck them. And they don't tread on me. And then the other side is like, how dare you say I take responsibility for something that isn't my fault. And it can feel like such an interesting place to be like, what ecology includes both. You have to be like in human development, 3 to 5 years old, you're going to individuate. That's really important. And I do feel like in some ways we have a culture, at least for those socialized as girls, that doesn't want them to be individual people because they serve the patriarchy better by not being individuated. And so we have like saying, okay, now we just need to focus on community can really activate those who have been only doing that and never developed a sense of self. And the model of the system of patriarchy and capitalism is endless extraction. And now saying, okay, now go give to your community more.
Oh, and yeah,
the response is like, what about me? And then that looks like hyper-individualism, where it can of course be, but in the work I do, it's typically, okay, and also you get to exist. And also outside of this group think, what do you believe? What do you feel? And how can they interact with difference? And I just noticed just such tension around the topic that it's an either or. And I know that you try to stay away from binaries as well, but like, how do you navigate that tension of like some people developmentally to divest from the system have to go to be the individual before they can re-engage in an ecosystem level?
Yeah. I mean, I think this nuance is really, really important. I'm really glad you shared this, because if you just blankly say to people, well, go to your community, it's the same as saying, well, just go to Bali or just take some time off. That's assuming you have a nurturing community. So if we're saying America as a whole needs community, but the community itself is a patriarchal model, that is a dominator model.
Yeah, the community itself is dangerous.
So because the individual part is important. You know, the analogy that comes up a lot is, you know, when you're on a plane and the oxygen comes down, you need to give yourself oxygen first. You do need to take care of your mental health and your experiences. And my ideal community would be one that recognizes that everyone's mental health, there's not one blanket way to treat everybody. A person socialized as women are going to have a different response than person socialized as men. A community that can deal with that nuance and honor that it's different for everyone is, I think, how we will thrive. And I don't think that's a fresh idea to share. So I think, again, in the conversations, like if I start talking about community quite often, it's helpful for the reframe to hear from you, for example, that, okay, yes, and, because I heard you say that a few times, that it's yes, and, like, yes, we need community, but what about those who've essentially not been able to develop their personalities? Or if you come from a family of, you know, a lot of people who've experienced childhood trauma at their formative ages or had to raise their parents, that's, you essentially negate your individual development and your individuation because you are working to keep your home space calm. The world I want to live in and the people I try to be around acknowledge that that's unique for everyone. But yeah, I think that's a big part of these steps we're taking forward, is that in order to have that community that you can fall back on, a community needs to build based upon nurturing everyone's individual healing. So it's both.
Yeah.
It's always both. And online isn't necessarily the best place for those things to happen, because the conversations are very reactive. And there's been a fair amount of research on how our fight or flight doesn't regulate, or fight flight, or our fight or flight or freeze response. It's a terrible place to regulate, because we don't see the bear that's coming toward us walk away. We just see something that triggers something inside of us. We react to it. And then there's no way for our brains to say, like, okay, the situation is safe. It's why I think so many people just go to their first reaction and fire away. And like you were saying, people say, well, they're going to take away my guns, or why should I be doing something to that I'm not responsible for? It's difficult. I mean, I compare it to relationships too. Like, I remember the way that I was raised to handle conflict, that what I saw, what I mirrored, was to bottle up anger, hold resentments, and then explode. That was a model that I saw. And to view all criticism or all commentary that was like, hey, you know, if you could help me out with this more, or, hey, the way you do dishes here, do you think maybe you could do this a little bit differently? These are sort of banal things that happen in relationships, but I internalized that those things were a threat. This was years ago. And I, in responding that way, caused my partners to be quite alarmed and scared in some circumstances, because they were like, whoa, this is not what I'm doing. It took time for me to understand that in relationships, you can cause harm. And I'm just using that as a blanket term, that you can love someone and you can hurt them without trying, that you can be living as a quote unquote good person and still do damage, and that it's okay to recognize that that happens and you're still a person who's worthy of love. You're still a person who's having someone turn to you and say like, hey, this affected me, but I would like to fix it. I use it as an analogy for some of the broader issues that people are resisting. Reparations, for example. I've heard folks in my life say, well, I didn't do that, but they're living the effects of those systems. And it's okay to take ownership of that. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It's okay to recognize that some of us live in circumstances that were beneficiaries of harm. And we didn't directly cause it, but it's okay for us to say like, oh, I didn't directly cause it, but I can still do something about it. And again, that took time for me to understand in my individual relationships. So it's not like something that was a light that turned on. That came from mistakes. That came from learning that the models that I had were toxic and being able to grow from them.
Yeah, I love that. Someone asked, I hosted a workshop yesterday and someone asked, like, how can you talk about self-responsibility with all these systemic harms? It's like, and I was talking about no longer trying to change what other people think as a way to heal. And they were like, well, how am I supposed to live that if people think things that are hurtful? And it was a really interesting conversation, because there is this like dance of, it's not my responsibility to coerce, manipulate, change, convince. And also by living what I believe to be true, which is the self-responsibility part, like, okay, what can I do to, like, if I believe that I want equity, mm-hmm. and that's my value, what is my responsibility to that? I'm not responsible for it happening, but I have a responsibility to my own value of equity. And that could look like reparations. That could look like so many different things. And also it also looks like not trying to convince my dad, who is an extreme evangelical who believes I'm going to hell for my lifestyle, that I deserve to exist. Right. And so there's this, like, for me, there's a boundary of where I'm putting my energy and trying to change other people, in putting that energy into something that is actually generative. Because I think we've all had conversations in the last couple of years where it's like having conversations that are challenging with people who are maybe slightly open or moderately open has been very beneficial. And I think a lot of us have had conversations with people who are like, fuck you. And that's the conversation. And to try to convince and change someone, it's just not useful. But I love the way that you're naming this. And I'm realizing, like, we're coming up on time and there are like 15 other conversations that we haven't had in this time. Is there anything that you really wanted to communicate in this that our little rabbit trails haven't communicated yet?
I know we've opened up so many. I feel like we could just continue. Yes. This is my favorite. I'm a big fan of tangents. Because I oftentimes feel like they interrelate. I just think for me, like, the thing that we're touching on is that there aren't clear answers, and the urgency to get the immediate answer that is satisfying is understandable, but living in the nuance of having these questions and then navigating where they take you is how we change. And it's just, it can be a very uncomfortable place if you didn't grow up in an environment where that was okay, or you don't live in a community where that's okay. You know, your example of your father, like, I can only imagine feeling that kind of judgment from a family member and your journey of, it sounds like you sort of veered away from trying to convince and turned toward, well, I'm going to generate with the people who want to generate this with me. And I think that's a very valid thing to do, like protect your energy. If people aren't going to be inclusive and respectful of how you live, when you are living in a way that is not causing harm and you're essentially just trying to receive and give love, then put your energy there. So for me, I hope that from this conversation, people take away that they're more than what they create, more than what they make, more than what they earn. And you'd be surprised if you have this topic as a conversation with the people in your life, how much closer you feel.
I certainly feel that. And like I mentioned, I feel like your approach to this conversation is so human. It doesn't feel driven by who you think is the correct political candidate. Even, I mean, maybe you have an opinion on that, but you haven't named it today. I'm assuming that you do.
Topic. Yeah.
But it feels very approachable. And the audience, I think, has a number of different opinions, but I think we can all acknowledge that what is happening isn't working for the majority of people. And for those that is working, extreme, extreme privilege is also, and is isolating and also traumatic. And I don't know that everyone likes to acknowledge that that's true, but the people I know who have lived in the 1% and like that very small group of people, some of my clients have come from those spaces. Mm-hmm. They suffer. And it's lonely. And not to say that it's not, there aren't a lot of benefits to also having that much privilege and wealth, but it's not communal. It's not a communal way to be. It's isolating. And it's a product of what you're saying. And it seems like the antidote to the shame and to the isolation seems to be connection. That's kind of what I'm gathering from this conversation.
Yes, it 100% is. And that's going to be different for everyone in finding what that is, but seeking connection, seeking a regenerative connection, seeking communities that celebrate you for the nuances of who you are, that celebrate your gender, your beliefs, your expression, all those things. There are a lot of communities out there that raise people up for their unique individuality and aren't about conforming you to a certain mold or unified based on hate. That's very inspiring for me. That's the thing I have to keep in mind when I get, when I fall into despair, reading about and living through what's been going on. There's plenty to be fearful of, but there's greater power in tapping into a world that's kinder and gentler, to use a common term, and wants us to regenerate. I mean, the planet wants us to live in harmony with it. It's very, very possible. And I think if we can tap into that, it's medicine.
It's very hard to be connected to people and to plants and to animals and not want to be living in harmony with all things. I think like it's very challenging to move into connection and realize that that's not the most important thing that there is.
Yeah. So. And realizing these things means we have to change. I think sometimes we resist. I certainly have done this. We resist new modes of thinking and new perspectives because our brain is just like, nope, if we change, I'm going to die. It's going to be too hard. It's going to be too scary. There's just an unconscious thing running where we resist breaking from the routine. But yeah, it's a much more vibrant way of living. You know, the opposite of shame is pleasure. And that has a lot of different connotations for people, but, fascism, for example, wants conformity and lack of expression, lack of color. And the world that I think I'm striving for, and many others are striving for, or the models that I see from others that I find inspiring, is a vivid and colorful one.
So beautiful. Are you ready for some rapid fire?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. What is your spiritual background?
A lapsed Catholic.
lapsed Catholic. I've never heard that one.
Yeah, it's funny. Catholicism has like an out. Like it's, I think Scorsese calls himself that too. I know this is rapid fire, but I think Catholicism knows like, you know, there's people are going to want to just go out a back door. So let's let them bail. So I'm a lapsed Catholic and Buddhist.
Beautiful. How do you know when you know?
You just can't deny it. It's mm-hmm. right there in your gut. And before your mind starts to question, the answer is always there. You just have to be honest with yourself.
What identities have you had to let go of to own your fullness today?
I've had to let go of my firmness and my isolation to let others help me. Mm.
What are you most enjoying learning right now?
I'm enjoying learning that the parts of me that would be deemed culturally feminine are what make me feel more masculine.
Hmm. What does grace mean to you?
Grace means gratitude at the smallest details.
Hmm. What is your go-to coffee shop order whenever you are out and about?
Whenever I want to treat myself, I get an almond milk latte.
Hmm. The last question is, what do you want?
I want a house by the river, a large wooden table where all of my friends can cook and eat together, and music well into the sunset.
I want that too. I'm just going to say, please, that's exactly what I want. That's amazing. Invite me over.
Yeah. It's like, I feel like if I, you know, Fields of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. That's my hope.
Yes. Thank you for tuning in to Everything Belongs. With the number of podcasts and content online and a very full life, I know the value of your attention, and I'm so grateful for every minute you spend listening to this show and having these conversations reverberate through your home, your car, and in your life. Thank you so much. If you loved this episode, please subscribe and leave me a 5-star review on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app so others might find this podcast. You can find the show notes for every episode on my website and find more out about today's guest by going to madisonmorrigan.com/podcast. And if you want to find a place to get started with my coaching work, the best place to do so is to download the Call Your Energy Back practice. It is a free journal guide and short hypnotic meditation to help you get into a daily routine of connecting to yourself so that you can take up all of your rightful space, embody your wholeness, and live with the power that comes when you really belong to yourself. You can go to madisonmorrigan.com/energy-back to download it right now. This meditation uses binaural beats, the brilliance of your subconscious mind, and powerful coaching questions to release the energy and emotions of other people, to generate a field of protection all around you, and will leave you feeling full of your true self, powerful, worthy, and whole. Now, if you're not already, please come and hang with me over on Instagram, DM me, and let me know your favorite part of this episode. And until next time, remember that curiosity can be a portal to a life where everything belongs.